Hello, and welcome to Manga Splaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by me, Deb Aoki, David Brothers, Christopher Woodrow Butcher, and Chip Zdarsky. Follow along with our show notes and reading list at mangasplaining.com. And we are now at the end of, is it season four or season five?
Season four.
And I guess I got confused because we are reading Akira volume five today. We are all, can you believe it, this whole journey of our podcast started with Akira. We are now in the penultimate a volume. And boy, it's a chunky little boy, isn't it? but pound for pound, this volume delivers.
It was so big, I thought Christopher recommended it, honestly.
To be completely fair, I did.
Wow.
Now, if you haven't listened to all our previous four episodes about Akira, I recommend you go back and listen. Or you could read your volume of volume five and do what we all did, which was read the synopsis in the front, which fills us in on everything that has happened since then. And boy, has a lot happened. As we embark on this journey to volume five, we were left on a cliffhanger in volume four where Kaneda returns. We don't know how or why, but he's back. Also, things are going pretty badly with Tetsuo, but he's had a revelation and he meets Akira with a brand new perspective, shall we say. As the story opens, we are seeing this amazing two-page shot of an aircraft carrier. Pretty dazzling. And things begin apace. So, did everyone kind of like reread before or kind of get up to speed? Like, what was your impressions upon first jumping back into it after so many weeks?
I just jumped back into it. I don't even think I had a thought that I should read the summary in the front. But then I was like, I've read this comic like seven times. Like, I'm sure I can pick it up in midstream. But I've read it in other formats so frequently, I kind of forgot exactly what was involved in volume five. Mm. So it was kind of cool to almost get like a complete graphic novel unto itself for this one, where like they set up a bunch of dominoes and then knock them down and then set up volume six, like pretty clearly. But yeah, I thought it was pretty easy to get into. But I'm a
David,
weirdo.
Does Akira feel like a series of volumes to you? Because you've read it so many times now. Or does it feel just like one long story and like the events aren't tied to individual volumes for you?
It's a mix. Like, I think volumes two and four I know really well because I had those in hardcover for so long. Mm. But like, I had the single issues. I had like the bootleg digital ones. I've got the Kodansha ones. I've read it. It just feels like one long story with like milestones that I leap between. So I like kind of knew that Kaneda came back around volume four, volume five. But if you'd asked me in the beginning of volume four, I'd be like, well, it's probably this one, but I wouldn't have been sure.
Gotcha.
Also, because like this does such a good job of not having chapter breaks. Mm-hmm. Like there were a few where I'm like, this is definitely, I think page 28 was the first one where I was like, this is a chapter break. But for the most part, it's just like straight through, which is always cool. Which I think helps me like get into it. Like you kind of get rolling.
Mm-hmm.
It's very immersive, right? To not have those chapter breaks.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Christopher?
One of the best things about doing the show notes for these, because they're really complicated. Like the Akira show notes are the hardest show notes I do all year, honestly. Although Nijishiki kind of give it a run for its money. And the biggest issue, I think, is this was so many different formats before the format that we're getting it. So things like I had to hunt down and figure out where chapter breaks were. And luckily, there's a couple of really amazing websites. I'll shout them out in the show notes that like break down what the original breaks were. But he really did, Otomo really did go back and edit this into a graphic novel. Like this is this is a one long story. And then even more than that, I feel like at a certain part, he stopped making this for weekly serialization and started being like, I'm just going to tell this next scene. I'm just going to tell this next scene. And the thing it reminds me of, actually, Chip, we talked about this when you were serializing the first volume of Public Domain on your Substack. You were just like, I'm just going to put up a scene at a time rather than a page every day or something like that. Mm. And then put that scene out there. And I think especially in this volume, when you start to look at where the breaks are in some of the scenes, those are just chapters. Like those were just like, all right, these are the 18 pages I can get done for this installment because it's so detailed and so whatever. And putting that scene out at a time, it felt probably really satisfying. And going through and like figuring out where the breaks are is one of my favorite things to do while I'm doing the show notes for these episodes to mm-hmm. see how it kind of all came together.
Did we, before we get too deep into the logistics of it, did we all like it? Are we still popular fans?
I thought that this would be the one that Chip liked the least, actually, while I was reading.
Really?
I'm curious. Yeah, Chip, what did you, how'd you feel?
It took me maybe a quarter of the book before I kind of warmed up to it again. Because I felt like the first quarter, it's just pieces kind of moving around. And I didn't really feel a lot of like emotional connection with the characters. But kind of as it kind of picked up, I'm like, okay, all right. Like it feels a bit more, there was more happening instead of just, yeah. Just individual scenes of character. I'm over here now and I'm doing this, but I'm over here, but I'm doing this. And it's like, okay, but what are you feeling? What's actually going on behind it? But you kind of get a bit more of that towards the back half of this volume, I think. But yeah, so I mean, but also like, as I was reading the first, you know, few chapters or whatever, I was just like, it's still just beautiful. Like it doesn't even matter. Like if we tune into a character that I don't necessarily want to find out more about, I'm still like, oh, but it's so well done. Like I'm still poring over the details of the pages.
Yeah.
So yeah. So even Akira that kind of like leaves me wanting is still just like miles above almost anything that's ever existed. So
So you liked it then?
So I liked it. I liked it. Yeah. Yeah. Kaneda, I'm getting a little sick of him.
I feel like there was a lot of cursing in this volume.
I mean, like, he, cursing, like, yeah. Like the whole volume is very one note for him. Just like, let's do this. Let's go kill him. Help this plan. I'm going to go kill him. I'm like, all right. We get it.
When I reread this, I thought, I remember Kaneda being much more of a badass or more of a hero. And in this one, it's like, wow, he's actually the comic relief.
Yeah.
He's actually the guy who takes it out of the lofty, the cosmic, the, you know, this could end the world. He's like, no, I just want revenge for you killing my best friend, you asshole. Okay, let's bring it back. Let's bring it back to Earth.
I like to focus on Joker. I like Joker. He was like some good comedic relief. He kind of picked that up from Kaneda. Because like I think previous volumes, Kaneda was actually kind of a lot more kind of comedic relief, actually. Mm-hmm. But the return of Joker is always welcome.
Joker is fun because he's one of the most like standout characters from the movie who doesn't really do much in the movie. Like he gets headbutted at one point. I think he like someone swings a metal pipe at his head. But in here, it's like, oh, this guy has a personality beyond being like a clown gangster.
Yeah, it's so good.
Like Chiyoko too.
Yeah, Chiyoko. Yes. She actually looks like an auntie at the end of this one.
Yeah.
Good.
But the bit where Kaneda comes in, he's like, hey, we got a plan. Here's what we're going to do. And he insults Joker first, and Joker knocks him out before he tells the plan.
Yeah.
Good.
Their dynamic is so good.
Yeah.
The one thing I was going to say is like Kai. Kai brings a lot of heart and humanity to this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like I love those moments where like Kaneda's back and he's seeing all these bodies and these skeletons and he's horrified, right? Because he's missed all the stuff that happened in volume 3. But Kai, you know, is like, he's both matter of fact about it. But two, like there's moments like when he sees a dead body in like the subway, he stops and he pauses and gives a little prayer.
Yeah, that was really good.
And then, you know, the moment like when he's reunited with Kaneda, it's like, you know, there's Kay, right? And like,
that was such a good sequence.
They're rushing together and they're going to reunite it. And he gets a big hug. And then he goes, wait, it's not the girl. You ruined the moment. And then he's like, I was really worried about you. And that was so sweet, you know, like, so Kai really came to the fore for me in this one too. Like his personality really came through in very small moments.
Definitely.
Joker grounded the series again because Kaneda's literally returned from the dead. He doesn't get to be an entry-level character anymore. He's not necessarily the one we project ourselves into. It's just like, no, Joker's like running a successful scavenging business and like repairing bikes and is doing physical things in the real world and just trying to survive with him and his people. That is more like how the rest of us are going to end up in Akira. You know what I mean? Like none of us are going to be flying through the air or shouting, you know, I can see with my psychic eye that the people are in our sector kind of stuff. You know what I mean? So I thought that was, he was a great character to introduce. Like, that was actually some really smart, especially with Chiyoko off the table, because she was also so relentlessly grounded in the book. Everyone else is like this hard military man with these like unknowable things that have to happen with the space laser and stuff. And she was just like, I am going to punch people until I get to where I need to be with Kay. That was great.
You got to play the hits.
Yeah, right? So, I don't know. I loved it. I thought it was great. But like Chip, I thought it took a little while to warm up. I have some thoughts on that. Deb, are you still in love with Akira?
Now, this is one where it's like, it had a lot of the things that I love about it. And it had this, even though at the beginning, there's this part where it's just a bunch of scientists talking. And it's like, this is like the first trilogy of Star Wars where it's just bureaucracy. like trade war, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you get to like page, 246, where it's like Kaneda and Kai are on bikes again. Yeah. It's like, woo, bike. And it's like, hey, there's no way we can make it together. It says, don't worry, Kai, I'll honor your memory. I'll take care of Tetsuo. You can rest in peace. Now get off. You bastard, how can you think of yourself at a time like this? It's like, I loved it. That was like this great moment where they're, obviously the stakes are high, but they're just being such, boys. It's
hilarious. Yeah, yeah.
This one really ramps up. I think the cursing stood out to me because this feels the most like a boys manga that it's maybe ever been because of the Joker, because of a lot of the stuff with Kay. Like even, or I guess rewinding to the scientists in the beginning, how they're very talky.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I totally see why that part dragged. And also it dragged for me too this time. I was like, oh man, this is the exposition book, huh?
Yeah.
But it's almost like they're explaining a bunch of stuff that nowadays would be like string theory or alternate universes or something. Like it almost doesn't matter what they're saying so much as it's like there's a power above all the powers we know and Tetsuo was screwing with it.
Yeah.
And kind of once I fell into that mode, things started flowing a lot faster.
Yeah. I mean, it was important, because that was lacking in the movie. So like when you watch the anime, it doesn't have that exposition. Like, why is Kay have this power and why is this and why is someone afraid of Akira? Like, it's not explained because it's only less than a two-hour movie.
Yeah.
This volume kind of like, oh, Kay's a medium. Oh, it's this and it's like that. It's like if you sit and read it, it gives you the context that if you only watch the anime, you didn't get.
I like how the focus was on Kay for so much of this volume and how she was different in almost every like segment.
Well, this one is called K2.
I was going to say that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never noticed that before. Was that in the previous editions that said that?
I think when she was introduced in volume 2, or not introduced in volume 2, but maybe volume 2, I think might have been K1.
What? Really?
But we'll have to show notes it.
Yeah. Oh. We'll go through. I'll grab all the titles.
How did I miss that?
Yeah. I think it's because the title page is like the least interesting part of any comic book.
Yeah.
I put so much work into
a collection like this. Because you're already in. I know what it's called. I know who made it.
Oh, another title page. Ugh.
Yeah, I ripped those out of all my comics personally. But no, Kay was great. It's like the movie, I think, makes her an interesting character. But this adds a lot of dimension to where she can both be like the sensitive, hey, let's sleep together before the final battle, girl. But then also the let's, like, where are your guns? We have to go rescue my auntie lady.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so many cool angles. I don't know. It's really good.
Yeah.
I felt like the introduction of the scientists was, I think we all agree, a weird moment. Deb, you saying it's like, when they all get together to discuss the plans before the raid on the Death Star does make the most sense for me. It's like, oh, that's maybe what he was trying to do. Because there's a couple real Star Wars moments in this, like the I love you, I know kiss that Kay and Kaneda share at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But I did think it was weird that you just like, we're going to start volume 5 by introducing 7 new people with full names and backstories. Like, and then 3 chapters later, have them crushed. Like
some of them.
Some of them. Yeah, to be fair.
All a little crushed. But the thing that was most weird about that to me was they were discussing things about like Akira and the different events and stuff like that. But I felt like everything they were discussing, we as the reader already knew. Like we already knew all of that. There was no new information in the discussion that the scientists were having. And I couldn't figure out why it was there. because if it's about educating us as readers, like, I feel like we already kind of knew everything that they were saying. They were restating it from like an ignorant perspective because they didn't know, they weren't on the ground, but we got to see all those events happen. So all I can think is this was a recap. Like, this was a recap designed for the readers, us, who maybe hadn't read Akira in a while. And then I was like, wait, is the break between volume 4 and volume 5 the break that he took the time off to do the movie? And that was the thing that I was most curious about from like a reading perspective, because it's real weird to have like a full chapter or two to start your volume 5 recapping things that we already know, if especially if we had just finished volume 4 like the previous, like the previous day or the previous week.
Yeah, I think it was, wasn't it? I think this was the break. I think we mentioned that before. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause we did take a long time. We took a long time in between volume 4 and volume 5 reading it. Cause this season has gone very long due to me late uploading episodes. But yeah, I do feel like this felt like a reintroduction. David, when you said all the pieces are put back on the page, like everyone, all the pieces were lined up, dominoes were knocked down and then, you know, set up again for volume 6. It felt a lot like that. Like this was, this maybe this is a good volume to start reading Akira because you find out everything that happened in all the volumes in the first 20 pages.
Yeah.
The trailer for Akira came out in 1987 and this volume started serializing in May 1986.
Oh. Okay, yes, that kind of lines up with when he would be done the anime and get back to work doing the comic book.
I do have an alternate take though.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Like I agree that it's weird, but I think it also gives Otomo a chance to set up some more conflict and like contrast between characters because this volume has such like an explicit military versus science and religion kind of vibe going.
Yeah.
Like a
group
of scientists are all like physicists and yada, yada. And then like a Lama, you know, someone to bring like, a mystic angle.
Yeah.
Who rules, by the way.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I kept like, it was such an interesting mix this summer that I kind of paid attention to what they were doing with that. And all the military people are only see Akira as a threat, as something to be eradicated. They're always like, any amount of losses are fine. We'll use bioweapons. We've got.
I mean, they treat him like Godzilla, honestly.
Yeah, like they really do. Like he's a giant monster. While the scientists are trying to find a way to understand and not control, but like, I don't know, figure out Akira. You know, what did we do wrong? What can we do? How can we fix this without killing people?
But don't you think this is kind of like, it becomes an allegory for how Japan sees America?
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, but also how America sees America, how everyone sees America.
Kind of like, you know, this is America, right? America is just going to, you know, basically use a dictionary to swat a fly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, like the thing in this that was the least believable was the fact that America hadn't just already launched a bunch of nukes at Japan.
It's true.
Yeah. Did anyone else see The Creator?
No, I don't know what that
is. Gareth Edwards movie. It's very beautiful, but kind of dumb. Oh. But it also
just like
has
me.
Kind of Chip Zdarsky, The Creator. That's the actual full title.
Love it.
But it has the U.S. Army as the villains, and they're kind of less believable there than in here, I think, because they are the kind of like full force dictionary to swat a fly, but they do it in such like a weird way that it doesn't like ring true. While here, it's almost like we have all the information. We see there might be like a way out of this that's peaceful, but we're going to use all of these poison gases and bombs to get things done.
Yeah.
Like it feels very considered, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like there's a moment with whoever, the admiral on the carrier, where the scientists are like, but we need, you know, to send in a report. And he's like, yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, send in your report and stuff. And obviously we'll take that into consideration, but we've already started this. Like, it was just like, it was that kind of, like, oh yeah, of course we'll pay attention to all the scientists and all the ideas, but yeah, it's useless. And just like, and what a soldier's job is like the president gives the order and the soldier does it and they don't question it. And then
I would say like, as someone who's worked at a tech company for 20 something years, this felt very familiar. It's like, oh yeah, we've done all, yes, thank you for your user research. Yes, those are very interesting findings from all of your tests. But we're just gonna roll this out and we're just gonna fucking hate it. And too bad, because we're already doing it.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. Here we go. Yeah. Windows X. Yeah.
What did you all think of the colonel this time around? Like, speaking of the military.
Hot, so hot. He's all shirtless and bandaged and paunchy, but
like
still
he had
muscly.
Like a belly. Yeah.
Yeah, it was, that was real good. That was real, not going to lie. I took a photo. It's going to the show notes.
I just love how every manga is an opportunity for a thirst trap for you, Chris. Yeah. You're in a mood.
You know, I'm having a good time. He was good. He was actually really good, this thing. And like, everything felt like a natural extension of the characters that, I mean, it's just a masterpiece, this book. Nothing felt out of character for anybody, but especially for the colonel. I thought he was sort of ramped up in subtle ways. You know what I mean? Like, there was definitely an upward arc on what he was after. Mm-hmm. And then they introduced that admiral, the American admiral on the ship, to compare and contrast different military ideologies and styles too, which I thought was so smart. Like, they started off that U.S. admiral with his, like, the things that Chip was just saying about, like, you know, we're going to do what we're going to do, but of course we're going to take your feedback and we'll give it all due consideration. Like, real subtle, like, kind of like F you kind of stuff. But by the end, he's just like shooting Tetsuo in the chest and firing nukes. And like, he is his arc versus the colonel's arc. Like, they're running in parallel. Like, literally, the colonel was shooting space lasers at people with his thumbs. But there is, they do have the same arc, but we got the admiral going from like from 0 to 100 in like, you know, the 300 pages of this book. And the colonel, we're still getting there. We're still getting there. Even he probably wouldn't use the bioweapons that the Americans Yamada. Were. Yeah, that Yamada would.
Yeah.
Stand upwind was brutal. That was a brutal panel.
Yeah.
He's now.
God. So yeah, love the colonel.
Mm-hmm.
Deb, what did you think?
Yeah, it's really fascinating, right? Because he goes from being their enemy to being their ally. Mm-hmm. And still not exactly so.
Mm.
Like, they still don't know quite whether to trust each other, but they're basically like, my enemy's enemy is, you know, my friend.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So it's interesting because I think they kind of like, they come to this point where they realize it's not a matter of who's in power and who's on one side or the other. They're both on the side of, let's just keep Japan in one piece. Let's get out of this alive. You know, like, it doesn't matter anymore if you're in the military or whatever, because frankly, the entire society has been completely blown to bits, right?
Mm.
You know, rank doesn't matter. You know, age doesn't matter. You know, wealth doesn't matter. Everything's back to zero. And you either have the courage to say, we can change this, or you just give it, or you just say, well, that's just the way things are and I'm going to roll with it. And so what you get with the faction that's under Akira is like, you know, these are the people who, you know, like after the war, right, they create the black markets, or they're like profiteers, or they're people who rush in to try to rise up in a power vacuum, right, in a societal vacuum. And then they try to make society back to what they want. Like, they have like cabaret shows, right? Like, let's have a pep rally for Akira, right?
Yeah, the rock concert.
Yeah.
Let's feed everybody, you know, let's follow the pattern. They're basically following the template of like how Japan was after the war, right? When it was blown to bits and then people had to kind of cobble a life again. But this has the layer of, but it's not a matter of Douglas MacArthur and the occupation forces. You have this cosmic force that people on a certain level don't even understand what's going on. They just want to live, right?
Yeah.
And then it becomes this faction of the Akira faction and the Lady Miyako faction, right? And even then, they're not understanding what's right or wrong. Who should we be with? Who should we not be with? So the colonel, I think, is in an interesting place because he's a piece, he's a symbol of the old world order that is now trying to find his place in this new world order, and trying to make order again in a world that's very chaotic.
Yeah.
Just out of pure will. Like, wow.
Yeah.
Did they name the aircraft carrier in this volume? Does anyone remember?
I don't.
You saying MacArthur made me think like, wait, was that the name of the aircraft carrier? Cause that would be kind of on the nose.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be crazy. Eh?
Yeah. But no, that makes perfect sense to me.
I was going to say, like, one of the things that stood out for me was the little moments of tenderness between, you know, Tetsuo. What's
the girl's name? Kay.
Kay?
No, Tetsuo and the
Oh, Tetsuo.
And Kaori.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty neat. You know, just like this moment where he's really suffering, but he just turns to her. Like, it's his one tie to the humanity he has left.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really interesting because there's this moment where in the beginning of volume 5 where he's kind of, you know, had this transcendent moment. He seems almost like a bodhisattva. And then mm-hmm. when he's on the airline carrier and then he starts to degenerate, right?
Mm.
Starts to turn into these tubes. He starts to, and the explanation is that his body can no longer house his power. It's trying to fuse with the aircraft carrier. So, yeah, I didn't expect, I forgot the transition, right? Where he goes from this crazed drug thing to this enlightened stage to this, again, crazed stage. It's like, oh.
Yeah, he's all over the place.
Mm.
And I don't think the movie does a good job of explaining the you need more matter for your power to work thing. Like, it just goes into a giant absorption, and it's like, well, that's wild. Like, this is great.
Yeah.
But this, the aircraft carrier thing, when he leaves and they regain control of the aircraft carrier, I thought that was kind of cool.
Mm. Yeah, like, that finally, these, like, it touches. Finally made sense for me. Like, it did it before.
Yeah.
So I think we're burying the lead here, and he blew a hole in the moon. He blew a hole.
I mean, in the so moon. Did Chairface. Like,
come on. So did Scott Pilgrim, or what's his name? Lucas Lee. But
One of my favorite parts in this, kind of possibly unintentionally comic, is Kaneda first noticing that and going and like, and the sea's coming up even higher and all this destruction, and he goes, "This time you've gone too far." Like, oh, really? Yeah, the hole in the moon.
That was it. That was the thing that did it.
Yeah, all right, I'm going to go kill you. Like, the fact that there's nothing in his brain that says, like, oh, you can't kill the guy who just put a hole in the moon.
It's true. Oh, my God.
You're a kid that got, like, knocked out by the guy, like, 2 seconds earlier.
Yeah.
It just never occurs to him, right? Very it funny. Never occurs to him that he's outpowered. Like,
Yeah.
To him, Tetsuo is always his childhood friend who he can knock some sense into.
Yeah.
And that's such like a shonen comic thing too, I feel. Like there's no end boss that you can't beat with like willpower and friendship.
It is.
Yeah.
You're right though. There's a lot more cussing here. Oh, sorry, go ahead. Tetsuo parts.
There's just some great Tetsuo drawings.
Mm.
There's just so many good ones, like where he's floating around in the debris around the moon, the ring around the moon he's created and stuff like that. And like the parts where he's like enlightened and whatnot. Yeah, it's just good where he lands on the aircraft carrier and explodes the plane. Like,
it's funny that like that this whole thing, the whole like celebration with also a side note. I love the fact that even in the future apocalypse, everyone hates shitty MCs. That's a nice touch.
It is a nice touch.
But like, you know, it's supposed to be about showing Akira's power, and Akira basically just says moon. And then Tetsuo goes and takes care of the moon. I guess that's the power, like telling this guy what to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was one thing throughout this book where I'm just like, there's this threat of Akira, that Akira doesn't do anything.
Mm.
And like everyone talks about Tetsuo as like, we don't want him to, if he keeps evolving, he'll turn into another Akira. I'm like, I kind of want to turn into another Akira because Akira doesn't do shit. Like Tetsuo is like actually dangerous and like doing all this stuff. And Akira is just like this kid just sits there and like, I think it's literally his only line in the whole book is moon.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
Yeah, which is wild.
Yeah, if you really think about it, right? He doesn't. Yeah, it's true.
No, he doesn't do anything.
It's all reputation and kind of like what the myth people have built around Akira that matters.
Yeah.
Like to the US, you know, he's the worst threat in the world. I mean, I guess he is like literally a planetary level disaster,
mm-hmm.
but like he's not a child. Say.
Yeah.
And to the major domo guy of the Great Tokyo Empire, he's a way to like keep and maintain power
mm-hmm.
or keep amassing power rather. But also like Tetsuo's hair getting lighter after he gets enlightened, I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like he looks different, just different enough to where you're like, oh, like he's got a different vibe, a different aura, he's more relaxed.
Does that happen in the anime?
I don't think so. I feel like there's really a couple flashes with like lighter hair, but it's like a visual effect more than a transformation. Page 169, when he just appears in the scientist's little club room. That's a scene that I liked a whole lot. Like,
yeah, that was insane.
Yeah.
He's just walking down the hallway previously.
I love how the priest, Pinga, just like all of a sudden he's been very serene, and every nun says a thing a little pithy and mysterious. And when Tetsuo comes, this is when he comes to life. He explains stuff. It's like, and he goes, oh, you know, this is what's really happening, or he's really feeling it, right? And then in like 174, Tetsuo goes, you see, there's a big difference between theory and reality.
Yeah.
Ooh, nice.
I like when he shows up too, he looks the most normal that he's looked probably since the beginning of the series. Like on page 169, it's just like a dude, like the arm is very understated. You know, he's, you know, properly dressed and calm and casual, and his hair is just like kind of short and
The hands on his hips is such a good pose.
Yeah, it is. I don't like, you know, when I'm reading this, especially scenes like that of him just kind of popping up and like being this presence, you know, the North American comics guy in me is always thinking of like stuff like Dr. Manhattan or Miracle Man. And like, I've never read Miracle Man, but I know David, you recently went through it. Like, are there comparisons from that to this?
Kind of. I think late era Miracle Man, when they get into kind of how having the power changes how he thinks, like he kind of ascends to godhood as a result of having godlike powers. Yeah. I think there's some of that in here, definitely. Yeah. But I think that Miracle Man in particular is so rooted in superhero language.
Okay.
That I think this kind of thing, where it's more of like a straight up sci-fi, like I've got powers, but not a costume.
Makes
it feel different.
Yeah.
Because Miracle Man always kind of comes back to like what makes, I mean, it doesn't literally say like what makes a good hero, but it's sort of like an exploration of how far you can take a hero before they stop being a hero.
Yeah.
While this is almost like, how do you build a god out of a teenager? And the answer is, please don't.
Yeah.
But doesn't he seem more older and more mature? It's like, then even kind of.
But it's, he does, but it's like a malicious kind of maturity.
Yeah.
You know, like he goes to the scientists, he's always in control. He has no fear of them because he knows that like they can't possibly do anything to hurt him.
And it's a maturity of like the difference between age 14 and age 17, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's not like he's ascended to be like a mature.
It's like when you first read about communism or socialism or whatever, you're like, oh yeah, I got this.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah.
Well, I did love Kaneda calling Joker a capitalist pig.
That was good.
Yeah.
I'm getting real film vibes from this volume. Like we mentioned Star Wars, but especially the POV character when they're introducing the scientists at the beginning of this book is just Stanley Kubrick. I think we have to admit that he put Stanley Kubrick in because he's such a huge movie fan. The like Russian scientist dude looks exactly like
he does.
80s era it's Stanley true. Kubrick.
And wait, so, which page?
Like the very beginning, like the first.
Oh, okay, yeah, with all
the Russian scientist, the dude with like the big
17 is black, a good shot.
Black beard.
Oh yeah, Kubrick.
But so thinking about film and how much he loves film, the thing that struck me about Tetsuo is that he seems, if you took out every sequence with Tetsuo, like with giving him an alien interiority, and it was just how other people perceive him, he would be a horror villain. He'd be like a powerful Michael Myers, you know, Jace, like something that is so far beyond our comprehension that he just shows up and he can't be stopped and you're at his mercy at all times and you're only like living by his fiat sort of a thing. And the way he like is stomping down the hall while the yogi, I don't remember.
What Karma, he is, officially. Punky,
yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Where he's freaking out. He's like, it's coming. It's like, you're supposed to be afraid. And all of the interactions with Tetsuo are people like terrified of interacting with him because he's just so other. And that gave me real horror vibes rather than science fiction vibes even. And that was really, really, really interesting for me that he was just, it's almost like he was in a different book a lot of the time.
A little more alien than aliens, let's say.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the beeps are coming towards us.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of overlap there. And I think it all comes down to like the unknowable. Like, what is he capable of, both like physically and also like as a person? Like, will he actually sink this aircraft carrier? Or
spoilers.
Yeah. Yeah. But the speaking of the cinematic vibes, there's one storytelling thing that Otomo does, I swear, in every chapter in this book, where it feels like a movie to me. And it's when someone meets someone else, they're like, hey, I have something to tell you. Then the next page is they've already said it and they're reacting to whatever the exposition was going to be.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, yeah, I like that technique a lot because it's almost like trimming the fat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, there's nothing you really need in there. Like, you don't need to know how Kaneda explains things to Joker. You just need to know that Joker's like, oh, well, I've got a flying ship that you can use that maybe doesn't fly anymore or something.
My favorite one of those was when they cut and the interstitial panel was the guy sneezing and then it went to the next panel where they've already explained what's going on.
So wait, which page is that one? That's great.
I think that was made in the volume. Yeah. I remember that one too. It was very fun. But it's such like a clean technique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There's so much good comics in this comic. Like, really, really good comics. The thing I wanted to bring up is about art and about simplification. You read only the first chapter of this and you saw the way that he was drawing fighter jets and the aircraft carriers. If you really look at it, they're little more than outlines. There's very little interior detail, especially in the establishing shots. And you're thinking, oh, that's kind of weird for a book that, I mean, we've commented so much about how like beautiful the like destruction is in these giant buildings and things like that. But I think it's really just masterful that he's only drawing what he needs to communicate like what is happening. Like, even if you look under, or actually I'll grab a real page number. You grab like one of these long shots where they're all sort of parked in the water. See if I can find one. Sorry. It's just, the drawings are very, they're just sparse enough, but when it has to be detailed, maybe I'll throw this in the show notes. They are, but then later on in the book, when they get to like, we're on the ships or we're sending in the fighter jets, those are just tremendously detailed, like so powerful. He knows when to pull back. And I noticed it more than once this volume. Here, this is a good example. This is a two-page spread where there's almost no backgrounds.
What's the number?
182, 183. And it's when the Yamada and what's his name, Ryu, when he's airtighting up his ship. And it's like, there's no backgrounds on that page. There's like a little bit of rubble in the very last panel on the spread just to give you to remind you where you are. But you don't notice it until you stop and go, oh, wait, he stopped drawing backgrounds because it's not valuable to what's going on. But when he does need there to be detail, like you flip over like a few pages to page, you know, 186 where they've changed scenes. And it's like all of those little shantytown huts are so beautifully drawn. Like, there's so many tiny lines on page 186 that just like establish a background that you could have gotten away with drawing like nothing of that, just to give what's happening some weight and some reality. He just knows when to draw it and when not to. He errs on the side of when to draw it, though.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've gone on about this over the last five volumes, but there's so many pages, so many panels where I'm just like, I look at a panel, I'm just like, how?
Yeah, you're right.
Like, it's just so much work, even just like the labor involved. I just don't know how.
I saw like a recent tweet from Studio Ghibli that was talking about a scene in The Wind Rises where the crowds are, you know, like this, there's this post-war chaos and it's crowds of people. Mm-hmm. They basically said it took them a year and a half to animate this because they didn't use any CGI. Mm. They hand drew all these crowds of people as individuals, like this teeming mass of humanity. And then you look at with Akira, right? It's like, there's not, sure, maybe he's grabbed a couple of scenes from somewhere else. Like, he and his team didn't redraw that crumbled building over and over again. But for the most part, it looks like they just drew everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, truly maniacs. Page 392 was something that stuck out to me in that same kind of sense that Christopher is talking about. Because he's definitely drawing too much, but there are some magic tricks in here that I like a lot, like the cinder panel. Like, he draws the label to decals on the jet. And I shouldn't call them decals, it's real life. But you know what I mean? Like, the little labels, like No Step, the pod launcher has a label. And it makes you kind of orient the jet in your mind. Like, oh, that's from the nose. This part is from the wing, even though it's all been destroyed.
Yeah.
It has an anatomy, right?
Yeah. I was like, did he draw like a jet on paper and then fold it up to find the right angles? And it's like, no, he didn't. He tricked me, you know, with a couple of like neat little labels and clues. But the couple pages before that, when the jet is coming down, page 381, and the pilot is freaking out. Mm. Like, I shouldn't have laughed, but it's drawn in such a funny way. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that guy's life sucks. Yeah. At the same
time. It really does.
David, you're such a master at finding these little moments that I just normally miss. It's crazy.
Like, drawing is just so cool. And with an artist like this, like Otomo, who does draw too much pretty frequently, like, the too much still has a whole lot going for it.
Yeah, like, he doesn't even need to put a word balloon going, it's like, it's just there.
I like, too, like, in the next page, 382, like, that pilot's still in that same position, the arms out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, yeah, it's true.
Like, I think it's also just an effect of, like, just the force of what's happening. Just, like, pulling everything back like that while still strapped in. It's so, such a smart little detail.
Yeah.
I like in 381, the sound effects are layered.
Yeah.
Like, it says go, 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 go. Like, but.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Those little rectangles. Ah, that's so smart.
Yeah, it's funny. This volume is the one where I really notice, like, positioning of sound effects. Like, sound effects that kind of cut behind things or, you know, cut off by panels. Yeah.
Yeah,
really,
like, really good. 401. Do, 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 do,
it
do,
made
do,
me
do.
Very grateful I could read the sound effects.
Yeah, it's too bad, isn't it?
Every time I flip to the back of the book and there's, like, the index of sound effects, I'm like, no, I'm not doing this.
No. No, that's awful.
But I'm almost glad that they didn't redraw it, because I like the original sound effects.
Yeah, oh yeah, they're part of the design. Like, 246, 247, where they're racing on the bikes, like, all the sound effect placement, just, like, you know, Frank Quitely is the only other artist I know that really does it like this, where, like, the sound effects are so incorporated.
Yeah.
That, like, I can't imagine why you would want to change those.
Yeah, the go, go, go in the bottom left-hand corner of 247 has drop shadows on it.
Yeah, like, yeah. That's the thing. Like, they're
it's like creating it like a shadow.
Yeah, they're integrated.
I kind of would say, like, one of the things I've never regretted, I've spent a good deal of my life trying to learn Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I've never regretted is learning to read the hiragana and katakana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that has really helped my appreciation of manga like this. I noticed that when I read Korean sound effects, I'm like, wait, what is this? You know? What are these circles and squares? It's just like, oh, that's what it feels like if you can't read Japanese. Ah.
A few pages earlier, 243, it was the first time I really kind of noticed that sound effect thing. Again, it's that, that drop shadow underneath.
Oh, that's genius.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, and even the page before, 242, like, the kind of the layered to go with the explosion just makes it feel like an explosion.
But it's funny, the line art goes through.
Like, it's pushing the letters forward towards you, right?
That, using that kind of depth.
That's super smart.
It's really cool. Yeah.
I have another small question. On page 199, is that a Nejishiki reference? Or am I reading too deeply into this urinating?
Oh, that pissing child, which is also one of the funniest, weirdest parts.
And that is a hideous child.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, maybe.
It feels so specific.
Yeah.
Because it's not really the style. Like, it's a different style, you know, that kid?
Yeah,
it's like true.
It, which makes it feel like it's a reference to something else.
Oh, I want to point out a little Easter egg. On page 330, there's a guy wearing a baseball hat. That's a nod to Domu.
Is it really?
The little baseball hat with the little wings.
Oh, it is. Oh, wow. Yeah. A lot of soldiers from their empire are there, too. That is the Domo hat. That's...
Oh, Christopher, just for fun.
That's good.
There's a breakdown of Lupe Domo. Fiasco's Food and Liquor cover on the internet somewhere. I can forward it to you if you can't find it.
I'm
doing show notes. The cover's based around Domo. Like, designed around him. Yeah.
I hope that... I mean, Domo is, like, one of the books that I think is criminally out of print.
Yeah.
It is really good. Like, if we did... If we weren't going to read Akira, I would say let's just read Domo. I think it's a precursor to Akira. And the way that he builds the mystery and the stories. Oh, God.
it's almost like he got his own Batman Year One and Batman The Dark Knight Returns with those two.
Okay.
Whereas he had like two classics in a very short period of time.
Now you're talking my language.
Yeah. Domo's like a single volume, maybe 300 pages.
And since then, he's just been teasing people saying, I'm going to make another manga.
Yeah.
He's such an asshole that way. Like, I went to the 2019 Anime Expo and he's like, oh yeah, we're going to do this new anime. I haven't seen it. Yeah. Oh, we're going to do a complete reboot of Akira, you know, like an anime series that's going to capture the whole series. I have not heard a word about it since. Yeah. It's like, look, dude, you're not getting any younger. Get shit done. Just saying.
Yeah. He's such an interesting creator in that front.
They already did those Japanese editions too. I'm just bitching. They did the Japanese like re-release of the complete Otomo. There's still no word. And we talked about that in our first podcast episode. It's like, oh, they're going to re-release everything that he's ever done in Japanese. David's got most of them, but they still haven't announced an English edition. So no new Akira, no Domu, which is still terribly out of print. Like, it's got to happen one day, but damned if I know when it's coming. How many do you have, by the way, David? I saw you counting.
I was counting. I have 10. They've released 10 so far.
Wow. Ah.
Kind of, it's skipping around in order a bit. So it's like 1 through 5. I think Domu's number 8. The Akira storyboards are like 23, 24. Those are absurd. I think Deb picked one of those up for me last time she went to Japan. Mm. But the first volume is stuff from when he was like 17 and 18, previously unpublished.
Wow.
And it's funny because you're like, oh, these are pretty good drawings. And then he very quickly figures it out. It's like watching a master born.
Isn't he like is this like some kind of conspiracy where they're trying to make us so impatient that we'll buy the Japanese versions?
I think they're so hard to make. Like, looking at the production quality, it would be a nightmare to produce, like, with American printers.
Mm.
I think a good way to show why it's so hard to bring out over here is they did a video of the wrapping process. Like, they put the jackets on the book. And it's a bunch of people in a line at a table wearing white gloves, like, wrapping books by hand and making sure they're snug and then packing them down to the assembly line. Wow.
David, can you grab a book? I don't think Chip's seen it. And they're majestic. Yeah. They're majestic. These new Japanese editions are really something special.
I grabbed Akira 24, the complete works, which are the layouts and keyframes, which looks like this.
Okay.
It is as thick as like volume 3 of the hardcovers, maybe.
Amazing.
And it's like the complete storyboards, keyframes.
Oh, wow.
That's all full color.
Yeah, full color. There's a pullout bit for... The camera's eating this up. Like tracking shots. Like, this is folded.
Oh, wow.
And my favorite part is there are clear overlays for some of the cells over the backgrounds.
Gorgeous.
Amazing.
And the book is printed back to front. It is a nightmare from a production standpoint.
Yeah.
I think it came out like 4 months
late. It's also got a neon vinyl dust jacket on it, too,
which is like transparent.
Transparent.
That's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Like because this is the Pi Books edition, right? It's called Genga. From the exhibit from where they had all this original artwork.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So what they did, instead of making a translated version of it, they just put an insert.
Oh, yeah. I was so happy when I saw that.
That has all the translations of all the interviews.
Yeah. Okay.
But this is a beautiful book.
Yeah.
But they didn't dare make an English-only edition.
Yeah. So all of this stuff, like the production value, it doesn't match the effort in the art, but it probably comes as close as you can get.
Yeah. You know? That's wild.
And because it's Otomo, because like publishing is so, I don't know, effective in Japan, like they can make these books and, you know, run off a couple of print runs or something.
Yeah.
But over here, like it feels so much more tough.
Yeah.
But the scale of printing and the demand there. Like, we can act like America buys a lot of manga, but, you know, actually the scale of the printing runs in Japan is not to be believed compared to the U.S.
Yeah.
So they can do that. Too bad.
Also, you could charge a lot more here for it, I think, because it is so specialized.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That's one thing we run into at work is we usually have to have, like, a higher price point than the original because of that.
Yeah,
especially if there are treatments or something like that.
Treatments, there's translation, all kinds of stuff, right?
I think what I'm allowed to say. Okay, I can talk about this one. So, Akira Art of Wall is the book I edited, which is I actually got the gig because we were talking about Akira so much on the podcast.
Really?
Oh, this isn't the boxer. That's the other.
And yet we don't get a cut.
Yeah. Yeah. Still not getting a cut.
Even I had to buy mine retail, man.
Jesus. But yeah, the English edition, I know that there was a lot of work put into print checks and print checks and print checks and print checks to match the Japanese exactly. Like, we were working on top of the Japanese files, which was really interesting, actually getting to see sort of how the sausage was made on that side. And having to match that was a really, really big deal. And I know that working with Udon, all the work that, like, I've been there on press check, not press checks, but they used to, back in the day, send press proofs. So they would print basically the whole book in flats, like 8 pages up, and then go through it, and we would color match. Eric Koh mostly did it, obviously, but would color match against the Japanese editions, because the Japanese editions were almost exclusively printed in Japan of any art book. And being like, oh, this yellow is like 2 degrees warmer, you gotta fix this yellow, or that level of, like, Eric's just crazy about making sure the books are the nicest they can possibly be. He did that Rose of Versailles. That was just like literally the best version of Rose of Versailles in print is the Udon edition.
In the world.
Yeah, in the world. In the world. That's just who he is as a dude. And I think it serves him well, because he's like, oh, someone's going to take the utmost care with our license. But achieving that is just, that's why Rose of Versailles was 4 years late. Like, that's what that takes. And I think that North Americans generally aren't willing to wait, like willing to put that kind of work in. Like, I know that North American printers or publishers, not naming any names, are constantly trying to find cheaper ways to print their books. And it's like, as long as the quality is good enough, we'll just shove it out there. Like, the fact that this Akira box set that we're all reading from exists at all is like a huge win, because like, this is actually really, really well printed. But once you see the originals, or you see the Genga book that Deb's got, to see like actually what the new quality of scans are on those original pages, we are losing, like, we do lose really fine lines sometimes, or they sort of fade out kind of thing. And it's just capitalism. It's just capital. It's like balancing, you know, cost versus quantity versus people want it now. But I will say,
plus, like, shipping.
Shipping's so subsidized now, it doesn't even cost anything anymore.
Yeah, it's also versus what people recognize and care about. Like, there's a smaller section of, it's like restaurants. It's like a fine dining restaurant. Like, you know, you could cut the quality, and like 90% of the people who eat there wouldn't notice.
Yeah.
But the 10% that would, like, it's like, is it worth that extra time and money to hit those people?
And some people say yeah, and some people abandon fine dining to do really nice burgers. And like, those are both really valid life choices.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we get the short end of the stick in North America sometimes in terms of quality. Yeah. I think anytime anyone wants to print something really nice, they go overseas, whether that's Europe or goes to Japan, or honestly, Hong Kong's printing is amazing, and India's printing is really, really good now and cheap, which is why a lot of the stuff is done in India. But if you're willing to put the work in and just do round after round of press checks to adjust colors, or to make sure that something like a scan is coming through clearly, and this is David's literal job, by the way.
I've got one of these in December. I've got a bunch of wet proofs coming in, which is, they do the entire book at a very high, they essentially print it on a giant like printer.
Yeah, you're getting the web prints, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wild.
Confirmed that there's no like Mori pattern, all the colors are right. We have like a little eyeglass thing to see that, like, the color dots, which is always kind of
cool. Yeah,
like a jeweler.
totally. And putting in that kind of care is like very time consuming and hair raising. Because like, if you mess it up, then the people who care really care, because it's so small, like Chip was saying.
Yeah.
But I think also, like, sometimes the work demands it.
Oh, absolutely.
Because even though, and you know, I'm obviously not like an executive or whatever, but like, I think that some work you need to like rise to meet the occasion.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't really just like shoot out like a newsprint Akira reprint, because it'll look bad.
Yeah.
And it will feel bad too, I think.
And I think the readership for this work can pay for this. Like, I mean, if they can pay for Berserk hardcovers, they can pay for this, right? And they will pay for it.
Mm.
You know, but I think the challenge is, you know, like, I think I talked with the people at First Second about their Hayao Miyazaki book, Shin's Journey, and they talked about what they had to go through to get the colors just right and get the print production just right. like, and they said, that's why we got the license, because we promised them that we would do this kind of effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but you know, you could argue that Kodansha and Otomo can, you know, there's a demand there.
I can assure you there's a demand.
I don't think there's anything nefarious about the delay. I just think there's just what we were talking about. It's just difficult to reach that level of quality at the price point that works.
I didn't know there was different weights of paper and things like that, for example, but like there's so many shades of white paper that you can print on to get a different effect, you know?
Yeah.
And all that stuff matters. And, you know, sometimes paper companies go out of business and you can't get that specific paper anymore. And then you're out of like the ceramic white that you need to make, you know, this illustration pop.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm sure that's available.
An exacerbating matter, the current paper shortage and printing shortages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got one further digression on this topic, but we should probably get back to Akira at some point. Shout out to Maurice Velikoop. I actually got to work with him. He's a Toronto illustrator and he does most of his color illustrations using Dr. Martin's dyes. And Dr. Martin's dyes are like, have an intensity to them that is not reproducible in CMYK for printing. Like, you can't be reprinted unless you're using special printing processes. So I actually got to work with him on a scanning, like a drum scanning sort of a situation, and printing a series of giclées of his very horny Greek myth prints. You might have seen with the Beguiling sometimes.
Yeah.
But that was an amazing situation because you got to see something come out, and he had illustrated it in such a way that you didn't think it was reproducible, but the technology exists. It's just that you had to sell a single print, like reproduction of this illustration for like $100 to make it worth anyone's time. And that's one page, but it looked flawless. Like it looked in some ways a little bit even sharper than his original illustration, because we'd gone in and like fixed a couple of, you know, lines and things like that. And it was just like, that's what the level is. Like, that's where the ceiling is. You can do anything, like with lithography. And giclée is a new technology. It's like the cheap version because it's digital printing. With like lithography and all the kind of printing that we have available, you can do whatever you want to, but it's just who's willing to pay for it. And listening to you guys talk about it, it's like, fewer than 1% of people who've seen the Akira movie in English have read Akira in English. And fewer percent of those people are willing to buy it again after buying the box, like fewer than 1% again. So like, what is the actual audience? Like, how much could they conceivably pay to license, adapt, print, and publish, you know, put into the world?
I'll just send them my direct deposit.
Well, if they ever do, they can sponsor this podcast, because God, we have put hours into Akira.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. We've gone for a bit on this one. Is there any other aspect of Akira Volume 5 that you'd like to talk about that you think stands out about it or makes it special? I will say that this was the thickest volume, so I was a little bit dreading it. But at the end, like that cliffhanger, man, I was like, oh, I got to read Volume 6 right now.
Yeah.
I resisted the temptation because I like to read it right before we talk. But that's like, oh, shit's going to happen.
Yeah, I think also knowing the next volume is the last volume, I also had that feeling like, oh, I just want to go right into volume 6.
Yeah.
Just because I know that's when it ends.
Yeah.
The only other thing in here that I wanted to point out was, I liked on page 55, I call it Chekhov's cool bike. The return of the cool bikes. as Kaneda is just staring in a silent panel.
Oh, yeah. That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like, oh, that's coming back in volume 6.
The bottom right panel on that page, the glass over his face makes his hair lighter.
Yeah,
and that's such lines a finer. Wild detail include.
Yeah.
Also, the jumpsuit.
Yeah, the jumpsuit was good. No boots, though.
Yeah.
Do you notice how Joker's face paint changes with almost every time he comes into the scene?
Yeah. I know. He spent a lot of time on it.
I love that he's getting up in the morning. He's like, all right, what am I going to do today? Tire trades or sort of a clown situation? Yeah. No, he's committed to the bit. He's the clown gang. I will say that the trend of some of the faces seeming like they're a little bit too real for the book that they're in continues. Kaneda's face on the bottom of page 267. He just, like, it's still, you know, it's Kaneda, but even stuff on the previous page and like elsewhere on this page, that face he drew, this time you've gone too far, is just almost looks like it's from a different manga. He's just, it's like a little too something. And that was really interesting. There was a couple pages like that in previous volumes, particularly with Tetsuo, whereas I feel like the really good, terrifying Tetsuo illustrations this volume are still fit the character, are still sort of in the same visual space.
God, there's so much in his volume. Like, we didn't even talk about a nuclear blast.
Yeah, that was huge.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, awe-inspiring.
It's stunning, yeah. I like the scene where the Birdman gets splatted on 320. That was pretty good.
I laughed out loud. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. And then I like when, like, Birdman 2 shows up.
Oh, Eggplant Man.
Eggplant Man. Yeah.
The Gugujube.
Squish.
That's kind of like Kamen Rider, right? Like,
yeah.
The different enemies have a different motif.
Yeah.
I think my version of that is on page 307, where Kaneda almost drowns off panel and everyone reacts to it.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was like, did I miss a scene? It's like, no, he just fell in like a deep hole of water somewhere and had to be rescued.
Classic.
Yeah. Good drawings all around.
I also like the other thing we didn't really talk about was Kaneda and Kay. Well, the kiss. The kiss is a really sweet scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, they gave it some weight.
I really like the fact that, like, when she's like, yeah, you know, spend a night, and, like, you know, he's horny. Like, it's kind of part of the character's charm. And he's just like, wait a second. Like, something's off here. Which is very unlike him. But also kind of shows that he has, like, kind of a deeper affection instead of just pure horniness for her.
Yeah. Like, he's come a long way.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some progression there, which I liked.
Page 329 is just so good. We need to let her sleep, Tetsuo. That's like,
I love an iconic. That.
Yeah.
That's got to have been on a t-shirt, right? Like, that's got to have been on a t-shirt.
That probably was one of the more expensive pages that Steve Olaf sold.
Yeah.
The only ones that are left now that for sale, and I was really tempted because he was selling up. He has an exhibit up at the San Diego Comic-Con Museum.
No. Oh, really?
About his coloring process.
No.
Yeah. And he had a couple pages for sale at Felix Comic Art. And the ones that are left are pretty much like the scientist talking. You
know? I love Dr. Hawk.
Yeah. I'm a Dr. Hawk head.
Well, you got your pick of pages, David. I think he still has a few left, but they are going fast. And if you want to get a piece of this history, go get some.
Oh, I will say I own page 151, the color guide for that one.
Oh.
I'm flipping through. I was like, oh, right.
Oh, hey. Oh, yeah. Nice.
Life is good.
That is a good one. Good job.
That's actually good. Yeah.
All the ones with Kaneda or Tetsuo are all so much pricier.
Yeah.
So nice.
I don't remember which page I have. I left them back in Toronto. I was speaking of which, this is the only book, this and Rose of Versailles are the only two books I moved to Taiwan and Japan with, just in case. So, yeah, that was weird. Thanks.
Cool.
Also, I want to say I like that Chiyoko's back. I like that you have a break from Chiyoko to further appreciate Chiyoko when she comes back. Mm-hmm. That's nice. And it's really, it's a lovely 401. Mm-hmm. Is one of my favorite pages from this.
Hmm.
Just that hug and the perspective looking through the openings.
It's striking how much her hair being down changes. I mean, it's true for like actual human beings too, but it's good drawing.
Yeah.
And also while Chiyoko's gone, everyone's like, where's Chiyoko? We have to go get Chiyoko.
Yeah.
Need some asses to get kicked.
Yeah, it's good writing.
but just 401, like I love that top half, and then just like the stacked panels below, like just scene setting. Like, you don't have to show everything. You're just building up to a thing. It's really, really evocative.
And then you flip that page contrast. And 402 is awesome. Like, that's an awesome page. Ooh. Oh my God.
Wow.
The street lamps and the signage and the collapsing buildings. And
yeah, man. Here we come.
There's a certain weight to it when you recognize some of these buildings from actual Tokyo. Like,
yeah, I try not to. It's too depressing, actually.
You know, kind of like the way, like in Planet of the Apes, when you recognize, oh, that's the Statue of Liberty. Like,
The Americans making landfall in Ginza, was that also kind of like a Richie Rich district back in the 80s?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Mm. It was a Richie Rich district back in the 50s.
A little bit of commentary there.
Yeah.
Since the beginning of buildings in Japan.
Gotcha.
Ginza's like Rodeo Drive, kind of.
Cool.
Fifth Avenue, I don't know.
Well, they also rebuilt that after the war specifically to be more Americanized. So there's a lot of very wide streets there. A lot of American, like earliest department stores were built there, really big spaces. So it is a deliberate comment. Absolutely. Well perceived. Yeah.
I'll say the sequence from 221 to 225, where he's blowing up the moon. That's gorgeous. Like the way that the stadium and the points to the moon, then you close in on the moon. And then the next is a double page spread of him floating in front of it.
Yeah.
That's stunning. And everything else is silent. No words or sound effects to clutter what's happening. It's just kind of
sound effects don't hit until 231 when we're back on Earth.
I think that that's smart. I think it's really interesting too, because they did a version of that scene in the movie, but instead of landing on the moon, Tetsuo lands on the laser, on the soul laser, and brings it crashing. I think he sends it to Earth, like crashing to Earth, right? Where it is silent, like the movie's been so bombastic and loud to that point until he lands on the laser, and then it's just silent in space for a little bit. And then there's a lot in this volume that is definitely different takes on things that happened in the movie. Kind of wild. I think Brian's talked about it, but they did Scott Pilgrim's movie. They did the movie after he had finished writing. The first draft came in when he was writing volume 3. And then the sort of final draft was after he had to plot out the rest of the book. So it's pretty close up to volume, I think, 4. And then afterwards, it diverges pretty wildly. But you could still see echoes there. And it was interesting to see that process from the inside. I don't know, if you ever cared to talk about it, I'd love to hear him talk about, you know, why he chose to do certain things, why there are similar scenes that happen in different ways in both the movie and the film. Yeah, but, you know, maybe we'll just get the the final anime edition at some point, the like accurate adaptation, and then we won't have to ask him. He'll just be able to show us.
Yeah.
There's always monks playing Listen to Me between the seasons.
There you go.
You hear us, Otomo, we'll talk to you. It'll be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this has really been an interesting discussion about Akira Volume 5. Any closing words?
I believe that's called final thoughts. I believe it's final thoughts.
Yeah, traditionally. Sorry.
Are we changing that for season 5? Are we doing final
words? No, I'm just riffing. Let's start with, let's try David. Dave, what's your final thoughts on Akira Volume 5?
I'm going to open to a random page 153, where Kaneda is like driving the machine with Kay and Chiyoko, and like the motion of the machine, like his hair flowing, like everything on this page is like kind of like juking to the left. It looks great. It's like a testament to how strong of an artist that Otomo is, that I can pick literally any page in this book and find something nice to say about it.
Yeah.
How about you, Chip?
Same. I mean, it's gorgeous. And like I said, like this is the volume that really made me want to jump right ahead to volume 6. It's upsetting at how gorgeous it is. Just knowing that no one will ever reach this level.
And Chris.
Yeah, that's actually a good trick, David. I can open to any random page of this book and describe how it is beautiful and why it is successful. That is a good trick. We talked a lot about the little moments that are all really good, but there's just so many of them in this book as well that, no, man, it's weird to do a podcast where we try to cover a volume of Akira in just an hour or so, give or take, because there's so much to it. I can see why some people have read it 7 times or more.
It's just me and Otomo.
Yeah, just you and Otomo, just forever. Most of this volume was new to me as well, so it was actually amazing to read it all fresh for the first time. Based on the things that I had previously read, I started a little bit later with Akira and then went back trying to find issues, interspersing it with watching the movie to get the gist of what the story was. And most of this volume was new, and it was, I didn't know what was going to happen. And then when it did, I was like, well, of course that's what happened. It was perfect, but it never felt, it never telegraphed. So yeah, man, Akira Volume 5. We picked a good, picked a good book to base a podcast around. And Deb, your final thought?
Oh, well, this was definitely a very rewarding read. It's everything that we've talked about before, the things that work, that show his mastery of the storytelling, this nice mix of humor and heart and humanity and cosmicness. There's lots of down on the ground moments of that are really kind of like worthy of the David brothers. Look at that. Look at that amazing little moment. And then these cosmic, you know, like mind-blowing events that are just like the scale of the action from both very, very down on the ground to very cosmic and huge. It's just kind of, the ambition here is just stunning.
Mm.
The ambition to say, I'm going to tell this story. I'm going to tell this story my way, at my own pace, the way I want to draw it. I think it makes me think and maybe feel a little bit sad sometimes that most times that the comics production, the demands of comics production, the economy of it, the time involved just doesn't allow for something like this to be created anymore. This kind of epic multi-year work that you can look back on it later. You may read it chapter by chapter, but when you look back on it later, you read the entire thing from end to end. It is such a piece of art.
Yeah.
That seems so well considered and so well put together, but it's still not, I don't know. I mean, of course it has its ups and downs. It's not, end to end perfect in every single moment, but it's so mind blowing to appreciate on both even as a casual reader and as someone appreciates the craft. What an accomplishment this series is. So props to you, Mr. Otomo. One of these days you'll actually come to a comic convention and reveal you're here.
Dun, dun, dun.
Duh. Like, he canceled on San Diego Comic Con a couple of years ago, which was so disappointing. Yeah. But y'all know it would have been a riot. And he did no autograph sessions when he did come to Anime Expo. So you're killing us, man. Throw us a bone, and not like you have a weekly deadline anymore. Come and do your victory lap world tour. We love your work and would love to meet you.
Or just stay home. I think it's fine.
Yeah,
it says Chip, who just came from New York Comic Con.
yeah, exactly.
All right. I think that does it for Akira Volume 5. We are eagerly going to get ready to read Akira Volume 6 at some point in the near future. But I think this brings us to the end of Season 4, yes?
It does.
Yeah, we did it.
Wow.
Next season, we'll remember which number it is.
We'll see.
So I guess we'll come back after a short commercial break, and maybe we'll have some shout outs, or maybe we'll talk about what we're going to do next for next season.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale. For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com.
That's TryLifeMD.com.
And we are back. And because we've done so much talking about Akira, I think maybe let's just do some shout outs. So who wants to go first?
I've got a shout out, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So I was reading a little bit about, as you know, I moved to Taiwan this season, which is weird. And the season has gone on for over a year. So whoops. I was reading a little bit about Taiwanese, Taoist religion and how it's practiced here. And I came across this short film called Kiss of the Rabbit God. And it's about a Chinese American restaurant worker who falls in love with an 18th century Qing dynasty god who visits him at night, who's the god of gay people. Basically, he was like in the 18th century, he fell in love with a bureaucrat and then was found out and murdered because, you know, gay people, it's awesome. But he becomes a god in the afterlife. They make grand god of forbidden love. And so he's the rabbit god. Rabbit being not an actual rabbit. Rabbit is a slur, an old Chinese slur for gay people. So he shows up to this Chinese American, young guy who's working in a restaurant, who's hiding everything about himself and falling apart. And it's really beautifully, really beautifully filmed. It's a 14-minute short movie on YouTube by Andrew Huang. I definitely recommend it. I haven't watched a lot of narrative stuff lately because it's been too heavy. And this is heavy. This took a minute. After it was done, I had to sit with it, but it was really, really good. And I recommend it. Kiss the Rabbit God. I'll put it in the show notes. You can watch the whole thing. I've also been rewatching Community and I'm enjoying it. Season 6, first time. I'm going to finally finish a thing. It's all right.
Whoa.
Yeah, right? So those are my two shout outs. We'll do some enlightened self-interest shout outs. I'll splice them in later.
I will take your Community shout out and double down and shout out. There was a season of Always Sunny that I missed this summer.
Really?
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Which I don't know how, but they never miss. There's an episode called Frank Shoots the Entire Gang or something like that. And you know the joke going in and it happens and it's still super funny. So if Always Sunny is your kind of humor, it's another good season.
That's so funny you mentioned it because I actually checked this morning to see because it's available here on Disney Plus in Canada, but they're always behind posting it because it airs on FX here. And so I keep checking every couple of weeks to see if the new season's up and it's still not up. And it's the same with What We Do in the Shadows, which I kept checking and checking and then finally up. I was like, it's amazing. Yeah. I guess What We Do in the Shadows is kind of my shout out for the week, just by virtue of that bad anecdote.
How about you, Deb? Do you have one?
Well, I'm going to shout out Hajime no Ippo on K-Manga. I paid for every chapter. It was worth every bit, every penny. So I recommend you do so because it's still the early chapters. So it's, maybe within the first, 10 volumes of Hajime no Ippo in Japanese. But it's so fun to read. Of course, the jokes about Ippo's elephant-sized dong is whited out a bit. But it's still hilarious. The boxing is still there. The action is still there. And, even if you're not into throwing money at K-Manga, at this time, I think it's worth it.
How much? Did you tally it up? How much you spent on it?
I'd say about $20.
That's nothing.
Oh,
that's very reasonable.
I thought there was going to be a whole other zero on that.
Yeah,
yeah, right? How many browser games did you have to play in between chapters in order to...
I'm too old for that bullshit, okay?
Dollar dues. Yeah.
Nice.
And I think David? Oh, you did yours.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that was quick shout-outs.
Wow. Yeah, boom. In and out.
Well, thank you for listening to another season of Manga Splinting. We are so glad that you've stuck around for us for over 100-something episodes, and we're looking forward to bringing you even more great manga in season 5. See you soon.
This has been Manga Splaining, episode number 112, Akira, volume 5, by Katsuhiro Otomo. Thanks for listening. And even though this is the season finale, we've got two more episodes coming your way before season 5 starts. Next week, get ready for a season 4 wrap-up and review episode, and then a week or two later, we'll have a very special Manga Splaining Listen to Me episode on manga and libraries with a very special guest. So as always, please consider supporting your local comic and manga specialty shop, and you can find one near you at comicshoplocator.com, or check out your local library for print and digital lending options. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangasplaining.com, and check out our newsletter and digital publishing endeavor at mangasplainingextra.com. Thanks to DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.